It seems so fitting to be at an educational institution because I think in my experience over the last 23 years in community benefit at a hospital and then a system level, what has been a real important piece of that has been ongoing education of people. So I'd like to begin with that. And to state also that I stand on the shoulders of many people who have come before me in the Catholic health industry and field. And when I came into the system at Catholic Healthcare West from one of our hospitals, I came into two religious sponsors of our health system who had just drafted a community benefit policy. And so my presentation today is on institutional level policies that we feel have resulted in very effective responses to community health needs. And I want to begin with the definition of what is a community benefit program and take it from the Catholic Health Association. It is programs or services that improve access, enhance the health of the community, advance medical or healthcare knowledge, or relieve or reduce the burden of government or other community benefit efforts. I think that's foundational. I'll tell you a little bit about us. We are the 8th largest health system in the United States and the largest health provider in the West. We are the largest health system in California. And I think for the purposes of this slide, one thing that is important is the community benefits and care of the poor topped the $1 billion mark for us in our fiscal year 2010. I'd love to say that the majority of that expense was in proactive programs and services to address the healthcare needs of our communities. But in fact, most of it was in response to the demand for healthcare services that has been unprecedented in the last few years. This is our mission statement, which is grounded in social justice teaching. Most importantly, that we are delivering compassionate, high-quality, affordable health services, not just acute care services. This is an important piece as well, that we feel our obligation and responsibility to respond and advocate to the needs of the poor and the disenfranchised. And we know that we can't do that without partnering with others in the community to improve the quality of life. It's not just community benefit programs that we have, which is the area that I oversee. I am under the umbrella of community health that also includes three other programs. They are our CHW community grants and investment programs. We allocate a percentage of our previous year's expenses, 5%, for every one of our hospitals. And they in turn give that back through grants to other not-for-profit organizations in the community that are addressing the unmet health-related needs, including the socioeconomic barriers for people in our communities. We also make investments in the community for more affordable workforce housing or for other socioeconomic needs that may be presented there. We have robust ecology initiatives, not only for the environmental hazards that we as a healthcare system produce, but also for the other environmental hazards in our communities, and advocacy efforts for it all. I want to take you on a journey with me that has been over the last 9 years, because it takes a long time to move a big organization. A lot of education happens as we evolve to where we are today and continue to grow. In 2002, we introduced the Community Benefit Governance Policy, and it was at a governance level, calling on our governance groups, our community advisory boards, to be accountable for what is being done in our communities to address the disproportionate unmet health needs of each of those communities, and we have 40. We implemented our first system-wide charity care financial assistance policy, and we participated in a very dynamic national demonstration project called Advancing the State of the Art in Community Benefit, which was led by the Public Health Institute, at that time out of Berkeley, California. They have since moved to Oakland. I think it's important to share that for that program, the key elements were that we wanted to have strategic focus to ensure access for communities with disproportionate unmet need. We wanted a proactive emphasis to reduce the demand for treatment of preventable conditions. We wanted to leverage charitable resources And that came into one of our values, which is stewardship of those funds as we fulfill our mission imperatives. And we wanted shared accountability for measurable results. So, at the institutional level, what we were asking was that we had an increased accountability that would result in better quality programming and sustainability. We wanted to move community benefit from the marginal work that those people did for those people out there to accountability throughout our organization at all levels of the organization, beginning with governance, moving through operations, through management, and through all aspects of our work. In the development of our programs to respond to the needs of the community, we wanted to be sure that we did three major things. One of them being, and paramount, to reduce health disparities. In so doing, we felt we could also reduce healthcare costs and ultimately help our communities to enhance their own problem-solving capacities. And this is a very busy slide, but I included it in your handout because I thought it would be of value to show you the elements that we included in programmatic measures. So as we do our community benefit programming in response to the identified needs, we ask for these considerations of five core principles. That there be an emphasis, but not an exclusive focus, on the disproportionate and unmet needs. We want to invest in prevention. I always argued with the use of the word primary in this terminology with our principal investigator because I felt that prevention meant to be primary, secondary, tertiary, and health protection as well. And so simply know that that goes beyond just primary prevention. We wanted to build an evidence-based continuum of care, critically important to the programs that we were offering already. We felt that we no longer can afford, nor can the people expect us to experiment anymore. We would really rather than have random acts of kindness that we offer in our communities to a much more robust, rigorous, evidence-based practice for their sake. The emphasis on community capacity building, of course, to increase our partnerships, and when we did, shared governance when appropriate. As our strategies continued between 2002 and 2006, we felt the policies in place now. How do we begin to implement it? What is expected of our facilities? And the key question became, what is the competency of your community benefits staff member? And believe me, that was often a person who wore many hats. Oh, you do corporate communications and marketing and strategy? Well, you're kind of familiar with the community. Would you do community benefit also? And so it came to our awareness that the competencies of the community benefit staff had to be bolstered. As conversation ensued about this with the Catholic Health Association, we partnered with the St. Louis University School of Public Health and have developed a certificate in community benefit program so that competencies can be enhanced for the people who are asked to do the work with much more rigor and effectiveness. We wanted to integrate our community benefits into strategic efforts. It was often that marketing was the primary focus of strategy and business development, of course. We wanted to take into consideration what are the needs of these communities, what are the socioeconomic barriers in these communities, and how does that impact our strategy. We implemented an administrative policy that complemented the governance policy and outlined for staff step by step how this is done. We also established a finance policy to ensure that across our 40 hospitals, all of the finance people were calculating the community benefit expenses in the same way. We also wanted to define the role between what is finance department responsible for in accounting and what are we in community benefit responsible for in sharing information about. At the same time all of this was occurring, our board challenged us and said, can you look at assessments of communities in a like manner? We had law passed in California in 1994 asking us to do our needs assessment every 3 years, and they're done in a variety of ways. Some may do it as a consortium of hospitals because they all have to do it. Others rely primarily on secondary data. Others hired outside agencies to come in and do it themselves. So our board said, can we look at it in a scientifically analytical way across the 40 hospitals in the same manner? So we partnered with Thomson Reuters, and we put together an ad hoc committee to say, what should we look at? And we looked at the socioeconomic barriers to access, including income, culture and language, education, insurance, and housing. They calculated this at a zip code level within each barrier group and assigned a barrier score from 1 to 5 based on the aggregate of those 5 barriers, and then assigned a score to each of the zip codes for our service areas. You can see beneath each primary barrier there are indicators. For example, with the income barrier, we were also looking at elderly poverty, child poverty, single parent poverty. The scores in these two areas are obviously quite different. In Scottsdale, Arizona, there was a very low need or risk based on those socioeconomic barriers. In Compton, California, it was a different story. We prepared for each of our hospitals a mapping so that they could see exactly by zip code where the socioeconomic barriers were posing the greatest risk. What we found was people who were living in the high-risk neighborhoods were twice as likely to be in the hospital for ambulatory care-sensitive conditions than their more privileged neighbors. That was a stunning bit of data for us. It mirrored the billing study and also some of the information many of you may be familiar with from PBS's programs on unnatural causes. The admission rate for marker conditions, such as an appendicitis, were pretty much the same across the board. But again, in those areas of high risk, hospitalizations were twice as frequent. So what are the ambulatory care sensitive conditions? They're medical conditions for which hospital use could be reduced if there was access to primary care. Prior ambulatory care could prevent the onset of the illness or condition in the first place, control an acute episode, or manage a chronic condition. This became a very compelling bit of information for us. Our ethicist said, you know what, this puts a face on the poor unlike any we've seen before. For me personally, it became a cry of the poor unlike any I had heard before. In 2008, our hospital president's titles were changed to service area leader, and they were given responsibility and accountability for an expanded role beyond the hospital walls to encompass the community. They also needed to have competency in population health. We took a look at roles have changed for the hospital presidents. We're getting new information. We have a new tool. How do we put all this together? And as Abby said earlier, what is the call to action? This was most definitely a call to action. So we started going through and looking at what's really happening here. Between 1998 and 2008, you can see our community benefit expense in a skyrocketing move upward. The demand for care has been very great. But the lighter green line at the bottom is our charity care expense. We were seeing greater expense happening in our Medicaid and Medicare populations, as evidenced in this slide over 4 years. It was a perfect slide up with the Medicare population. And what was one of the primary complaints? Chronic conditions, ambulatory care sensitive conditions. We found it to be very true in our Medicaid population as well. So it was establishing a business case because we had a lot of people to convince that we needed to focus our efforts very strategically. There was a time when hospital presidents would say to us, please don't touch my Medicare population. That's where most of my revenue comes from. However, when our studies showed them this, that for ambulatory care sensitive conditions, with the exception of one hospital that was rural with a higher reimbursement rate, every one of them was losing money on ambulatory care-sensitive conditions. I had to learn a new language. It's real easy for me to speak about community benefit with our mission folks. It wasn't so easy to talk about it with people in strategy and business development or operations. Governance was very open-minded and very supportive, as was the leadership of our organization and our CEO, Lloyd Dean. But convincing the hospital presidents of the business case and the finance officers and the operations folks was another story. So I learned the language. By reducing complications, we could improve patient outcomes and decrease length of stay. By focusing on reducing admissions and/or length of stay in this patient population, It would free the capacity for those patients in greatest need for acute care services. It is also a demonstration of respect for our community members and stewardship of our resources. We honor the trust given to us by our communities for our not-for-profit status and ask ourselves again and again, how would they like that trust spent? I am sure it is in proactive approaches to improve their health, enhance their health, and avoid the hospital admissions wherever possible. So we introduced a system metric. What is measured is done. What is financially incentivized is really paid attention to. And so in addition to our policies, we introduced metric goals for our system leadership to help reduce the readmissions and participants in the hospital's prevention program. And we asked them to specifically identify a health issue in a neighborhood with disproportionate unmet health-related need, as indicated by our community need index, our community needs assessment, and hospital-specific data. We asked them to focus on one of the four ambulatory care-sensitive conditions listed, or if, in fact, they were looking at a specific problem in their community with great rigor, that we wanted to support that as well, and that was a patient navigator program for unassigned people in the emergency department. Our objective was to reduce health disparities. And 5% decrease, we felt, was something of a stretch for them to achieve. We also introduced a finance metric the following year and said, in order to continue with something like this, we're going to ask you to increase your proactive investment in community benefit programming by at least 10%. Because unless and until you increase the work that you're doing in the community, the demand will continue to rise. Here's what happened. A reduction in readmissions in our California Hospital Medical Center, which is in the heart of Los Angeles, the highest need area, showed an 84% decrease for uncontrolled diabetes. I put in here the average cost per case for those who are interested in what does that equate to in dollars. In our Sacramento area of congestive heart failure program, reduced readmissions for the participants in our program by 80%. The outcome of a three-year initiative for that metric, which concluded last June, was that among our 40 hospitals, we invested a little over or almost $6 million in preventive disease management programs. 8,917 individuals participated in them, and we saw an average 86% reduction in readmissions for those ambulatory care-sensitive conditions. We learned more than that. In one of the programs that we offered, a 90-year-old woman wrote to us, "We learned to deal more effectively with anxiety, anger, pain, depression, and emotion. I have more confidence in myself." So quality of life had been enhanced. Going forward, we've asked them, build on that. Pull out a second one that you're looking for. Help to absolutely concretize a disease management strategy at every one of our hospitals to address these unmet needs in our communities. This is somewhat of an overview of how we did this, and that is we're grounded in our mission, vision, and values. We align governance, management, and operations. We codify the expectation by policy and outline the work of community benefit as being, what do the people need? What are the underlying causes of it? What can we do to address it? Who can we work with? How will we ensure effectiveness and sustainability of our programs? And ultimately, have we made a difference in the lives of the people whose experiences we've touched and who we've helped by educating? With all of that in place, we are seeing a demonstration of improved access and quality, a reduction in health disparity, and a decrease in cost. Also, the improved quality of life, which goes back to our mission statement, so it goes full circle. So are we ready for questions?
We are. Thank you very much. I'll start by asking about what are some of the strategies for strengthening partnerships with community-based organizations? How do we engage some of the groups working on the ground locally to help prioritize these efforts?
I think that one of the greatest gifts to our communities has been the Community Need Index. It is also a gift to you. Included in your slides is our website. We've made it available nationally for everyone to use at a zip code level. But sharing the information, for example, in Stockton, was a major surprise to the group that worked together of one area that was a high need. And they found that the children's school lunch program, they have greater than 50% of the children on it. And so when there is a compelling need, the partners around the table work together to strategize how they might begin to address it. So no data, no problem. I can't begin to tell you how important the sharing of data is.
A question over here.
Hi, Barbara Leonard from the Maine Health Access Foundation, and I work a lot on payment reform issues, and I also work a lot on access to care. And one of the questions that I keep asking myself is, okay, accountable care organizations, accountable to whom? And I would love to put what you've done and some of the payment reform efforts into a jar and mix them up, because I'm absolutely convinced that until we start solving problems for all populations, no matter who their payer is, we're not going to actually improve health of populations and communities. So I wonder if you have any comments about whether there have been discussions at your hospital about this. I frequently get asked, well, how can we deal with all those underserved and uninsured people when we're working with this corporation who's going to help us with our accountable care organization? And I say, we have to do both.
That is, you are absolutely correct. You do have to do both. I just served on a committee at our system regarding our response to the accountable care organization standards, or you know, the guidance that was offered, and had my particular focus on patient-centered care, talking primarily about how important it is to have the continuum of care in place, that we so often think only of ourselves. We are just one piece of the broader health needs that people have, and usually for an acute or emergency care need. But you are correct that working together, there has to be a blending of accountability. And the accountability is to the people we're serving. So I think that for us in our not-for-profit status, we've always said our primary accountability is to that community for the trust that they have placed in us. So we try to honor that trust with a proactive approach to improving or sustaining it.
Question over here.
Thank you very much to the panel. I really enjoyed your presentation. I'm Oxides Bargo. I'm the Health Commissioner for Baltimore City. And my question was, regarding the investment that the Catholic Health Network made in terms of the prevention dollars, and because it mirrors very much what we're trying to do here in Baltimore City in terms of working with all of our hospitals to get them to align around ambulatory care-sensitive indicators as a way to improve health outcomes. And the question in terms of making the business case, you talked about the fact that you invested $6 million and that there were 9,000 individuals that took advantage of, or that benefited from this investment. And I'm wondering if you have any data on dollars saved, because I assume that these were probably high utilizers. And in terms of helping to make the business case, from our perspective, it would be great to have some data on dollars saved.
The only thing I can offer you is that we try to do the average cost of a stay for the ambulatory care sensitive condition that was being addressed for each hospital. And I included that in the slide for those two examples. So that gave you a bit of an idea of what the savings may have been. But our conservative estimates were at least $50 million.
Other questions? All right, please join me in thanking our speakers.